Let me go ahead and mention before I forget, Johnny just told me there are going to be handouts for Sunday morning's Bible class. So I hope you've been thinking about that. He's going to be in 1 Peter chapter 1. So you may go ahead and be reading through that this week. So in preparation for Sunday morning class, we're piling up quite the number of handouts in the back. We may have to get a bigger table. So I've got two handouts. There's a bulletin. Now Johnny's going to have a handout. There's Wednesday night handouts. So just make sure you're staying up to date on all the paperwork. And I know that's not getting lost by any means. All right, we're back in Ezra. Going to be looking at chapters 2 and 3 tonight, maybe a little more. Remember the book of Ezra. It's one book with Nehemiah, Ezra and Nehemiah. Both of them tell of post-captivity events regarding the children of Israel. And largely what the book of Ezra is about is the first and second group of Jews that return from exile to the land of Judea, particularly to the city of Jerusalem and the surrounding towns, surrounding villages. And as we're going to see tonight, they're going to begin reconstruction of the temple so that they can return to the worship of God. Just let me make one brief comment. This was brought up last week in Ezra chapter 1 and verse 9. There seemed to be some disagreement between various translations as to some of the goods that were sent back. Remember, whenever Cyrus sent the people back, he sent them back with all of the treasures that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took whenever he defeated the Judeans and when he ransacked Jerusalem, sent all of the goods and vessels of the temple back with them. And there was a little bit of uncertainty in verse 9 as to whether that last item mentioned in verse 9, the ESV says 29 censers, King James Version and New King James Version, and a handful of others. Some render it knives, some render it censers. I went back and just did a little bit of digging on that as to why there might be a seeming discrepancy between the multiple different translations. And it really just comes down to translators themselves. The word itself in the original language is only used a single time in the entire Bible. And it's a word that they just weren't real certain as to what it meant. It had entomological ties to different things. And so there wasn't just any degree of certainty that they could look at and say, well, this is definitely sure what that word meant. There is some extra-biblical uses of it by which they could kind of get an idea, but different translators had different ideas and just things that have in the translation process. If you've never studied much into the process of how the Bible is translated, it's quite an interesting study, but there is a lot of science, there's a lot of understanding, a lot of knowledge that requires. And so there's a lot of work that goes into the work of translating. And so it really all boils down to the fact that they're just not 100% sure what that word exactly means. And so different translators have rendered it in different versions, some as knives, some as censers, and some in other ways as well. So regardless, we can take comfort in knowing that this isn't going to have any understanding. And having a correct understanding of what exactly it was they brought back is not going to have any impact on your salvation. So there's no need for concern in that regard. So, yes, Tommy?
Yeah, one thing I think we can be assured of, that all of these items, whatever you call them, was something that was used in the sacrificial service.
Yeah, they were holy vessels that were used. So we read that list, and you kind of just skim through that and think, okay, they just took the treasure back, the temple treasure back. What was absent from the list? Things they didn't take back that were prominent objects. Ark of the Covenant. That's one of the things that wasn't mentioned. Not only that, but the bronze altar, the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the candlestick. So those unique instruments that had a purpose in the worship of God in the temple system, many of those weren't taken back. And as we're going to see, they're going to actually have to reconstruct the altar. In fact, that's what chapter 3 is going to largely be about, is the reconstruction of the altar. Because some of those, not all of the articles returned. And at this point, the Ark of the Covenant steps off of the scene. So you never see or hear of it again. And it appears to have been lost somewhere in the midst of Babylonian captivity. Yes, sir?
Mm-hmm. And the altar, when it was captured and taken back, it mentions that those big items were broken up.
Okay.
So
Yeah. Yep. It makes you wonder if the Ark of the Covenant was broken up, and that would not be a good experience for whoever got charged with that task, would it have been? Yeah, who knows what happened to it? So all we know is it was there whenever the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, and it didn't come back. So that may have been one of those things on Moses' body. The Lord took care of that, and we just aren't intended to know exactly what that was. So yeah, the reason that would have probably been broken up is it would have showed the strength of the deity of the Babylonians defeating the deity of the Israelites. That's how they would have viewed it. And so they would have torn down some of the instruments used in the worship of God, in the worship of Yahweh. And in their mind, that's him showing his superiority, or the Babylonian God's superiority over the God of Israel. So that's why some of those objects would have been destroyed, and why some of them would have been taken back. So Ezra chapter 2 is a rather lengthy chapter. And if you've looked through it, then you've noticed there are a lot of names. And if you tried to read it, you probably realized a lot of those names are hard to pronounce. So we're not going to read much of, we're going to read a little bit, but we're not going to read much of Ezra chapter 2. But I do want to kind of talk about the events that are going on, because it is significant. And just in general, what's happening is the exiles are returning from captivity under the reign of Persia to Jerusalem. And you see verse 2, there's a couple of names that ought to stand out to us. And we'll talk about why these names are mentioned a little bit later on. So they came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reliah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Baana. So those people in verse 2 seem to be the leaders who brought the people of Israel back. Largely, the book is going to focus on the leadership of Zerubbabel and the leadership of Jeshua. The Nehemiah mentioned here, important to notice, is not the Nehemiah that we know later, who the book of Nehemiah is named after. Okay, he's going to actually come some 60 years later. So this is not the same Nehemiah. Also worth mentioning, this is not the same Mordecai from the book of Esther. You probably recognize both of those names, but it's not the prominent Mordecai, and it's not the prominent Nehemiah that we know from the book of Esther and from the book of Nehemiah. Those were relatively common Jewish names, and so it's not surprising to find out that, you know, just as we know many people that share our unique names, those were common names that many Jews had back then. But the primary leaders of the people who brought them back are Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Now, Zerubbabel would have been, if you want to describe him in this way, he would have been the rightful leader of Judah, and he's going to be a key part of the restoration. The reason I say that he's the rightful leader of Judah, if Judah still had kings, then he would have been the one who would have been the king at that time. However, he never served as a king, because one of the last kings by the name of Jehoiachin, he was cursed back in Jeremiah chapter 22. And what the Lord said was that Jehoiachin was never going to have a descendant to ever sit on the throne again. Okay, and so Zerubbabel was a descendant from the Davidic lineage, but he's not going to reign in the capacity of king, in part because of Jehoiachin's curse. When you go and you read in Matthew chapter 1, you see Zerubbabel's name. That is, he's in the lineage of Jesus. Jesus is king. He sits on David's throne. So how is that possible with Jehoiachin's curse that no one from the lineage, his lineage, is going to sit on the throne? But how does Jesus sit on the throne? How do we reconcile that? Anybody know?
The other side of the lineage.
The other side of the lineage.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Female.
All right. Whose lineage is Matthew giving? We know from our study in Luke that Luke is giving Mary's lineage, right? So that's the lineage of Joseph. All right. Joseph is not the father of Jesus. He's the stepfather of Jesus. And so the prophecy can be kept intact. That is, no son of Jehoiachin's lineage is ever going to sit on the throne. He's the adopted son of Joseph. And so his physical lineage comes from Mary. Okay, and so it bypasses the curse, and thus Jesus is able to sit on the throne of David, and the curse was bypassed from Mary's side, because Mary came from Nathan's side of the family. So Zerubbabel is part of the Davidic lineage. He is part of the lineage of Jesus on Joseph's side. And if there was a king, it would have been him. And he's one of the leaders, the civic leader of the people. The religious leader of the people is a man mentioned right after Zerubbabel. That is Jeshua. Some versions may refer to him as Joshua, or in other places he's referred to as Joshua. He's the high priest. So you have the civic leader, Zerubbabel, and you have the religious leader, Jeshua. So they're both of these men are playing very important roles in the reestablishment of the temple and the worship and the priestly order. And as mentioned, the Nehemiah and the Mordecai that are mentioned here, neither are the well-known, prominent Bible characters that we know. Although they are tied closely to that time period, they aren't the same ones that are mentioned here. Now, verses 3 through 19, were we to read them, and you know, if you kind of looked at this text beforehand, there's a bunch of names and there's a bunch of numbers. I'm just going to kind of break it up so we can understand what he's describing here. In verses 3 through 19, there are a list of people who return home by family. That is, this is the genealogical ties, and these are the ones that they brought back with them. In verses 20 through 35, there's another group of people. And these are all commoners. We would call them commoners in the sense as compared to, as we're going to see, religious leaders or men of influence. And so they were just, you know, regular lay people, for lack of a better term. They're listed not by family, but by their hometown. So where they're returning to. So you have some mentioned by family. You have some mentioned by the place that they were returning to. And then the rest of the chapter, verses 36 down through about verse 63, you have the religious leaders or the people of religious influence, those who are going to be involved in the worship of God. The priests are mentioned there in verses 36 through 39. Four divisions return to Jerusalem. And David, whenever he was organizing the priests by division, there were 24. So what we see is only a small number of priests, four out of 24 divisions, return to Jerusalem. The Levites there in verses 40 through 42, some of them were, let's just look at these and see if are there any names that I can't pronounce in here. Probably. Okay. Do notice though, verse 40, the Levites. Verse 41, the singers, sons of Asaph. You see that name Asaph coming up in the Psalms? He was the man that David appointed to be one of the men who led the song worship in that temple dispensation. He had sons that went back from the captivity. The sons of the gatekeepers.
Are those not classes? Or just
Are they not part of a division? Verses 36 through 39 are the priests. That's what I was referring to as the four divisions. Yeah. So the priests, Jedidiah of Jeshua, Immer, Pashur, and Harim. So there's four divisions there in verses 36 through 39 of the priests. Yeah, these are I think what you're getting at. These are people who had specific jobs under the Levitical system. You have the Levites in verses 40 through 42 who were assistants to the priests. You have the temple servants in verses 43 through 54. They kind of have a unique story. Does anyone know who the temple servants are? Where they came onto the scene? Long, long time ago in Israel's history. Anybody call to mind? Anybody remember? Tommy, you remember?
I think so.
Where'd they come from?
Well, those, I can't remember the name. But there's the ones that dressed up like in real old clothes and come in old bread, moldy bread and stuff, and they tricked Joshua and the leaders. Canaan going into leave with them when they were not.
Yeah. Home. Yep. Yep, that's good. Yep, the Gibeonites, Joshua chapter 9. So I was going to ask somebody to tell the story, but you pretty much done that. So these are the descendants of the Gibeonites. They made peace with Israel. They were people that were to be destroyed. Joshua did inquire of the Lord, and so they had to honor the terms of peace. And so he cursed them and essentially said, you're going to be carrying water and you're going to be chopping wood. So that was pretty much what they did. They were temple servants, descendants of the Gibeonites. They had a special quarter in the city of Jerusalem, and so they were honored. They were exempt from taxes. Not only that, but you're going to later see that they were helping Nehemiah in rebuilding the wall. So they kind of fly under the radar as far as what we know about them, but they're people of great significance, and it all comes from the faith of the Gibeonites way back in Joshua chapter 9, who were able to avert the destruction of their people through faith in God, very similar to what Rahab did. Dad?
It's interesting. Had a bunch of them executed, and they came to David and asked for compensation. And David turned over seven of Saul's male relatives to be killed to replace the ones that he had killed of them.
Yeah.
Recompense.
Yeah. And that shows you just how God honored that vow. They shouldn't have made the vow, and they realized that. God told them, don't make peace with them. But whenever Saul killed some of the Gibeonite people, the Lord brought a famine on the land during the days of David. And David intercedes and figures out that what had happened is Saul killed some Gibeonites. And so, you know, the Gibeonites come, and he hands over, as you pointed out, some of the men of Saul. And it wasn't until justice was satisfied for the breaking of that vow that the famine that had come upon the land was brought to an end. So,
I don't know if he didn't have a lot of options. The four of those seven were the sons of Miriam, the wife that Saul had promised him, and later he took away and gave to another man.
Well, truthfully, it's surprising that they were allowed to be alive at all. You know, if you think about it, because one of the things that frequently happens whenever a new king during those times came into power, you get rid of the competition, which is essentially what David has Solomon do whenever he ascends to the throne, is he has him get rid of all of the people who might be competition. So it's pretty surprising that they were allowed to be alive at all, in my opinion, with the exception of the promise that David made to Jonathan and Mephibosheth, and allowing him to hold that seat at the table. So that promise of friendship kept Mephibosheth's lineage alive. But yes, he did turn some of Saul's family over as judgment for what Saul had done. And so,
in our terminology, it was his ex's sons.
Yeah. Yeah, just not a very good not a very good situation there, and just in general.
He deliberately chose them, or whether he just didn't have a lot of options with the remaining men in Saul's family.
I don't know. I'd hesitate to guess as to why it was. Maybe the Lord revealed it to him, because we know that the Lord told him, you know, this is why the land's being plagued. So he may have revealed who it was that was to be handed over, or that could have been made up to David's discretion. Anyway, these first three groups, the priests, the Levites, and the temple servants, they're all going to be instrumental in reforming the temple. A little bit later, in verses 59 through 63, we see a group of what's called the unregistered priests. So they're people who had a claim, a verbal claim, saying we can trace our lineage back to the Aaronic dynasty, but they couldn't give any sort of validation of that. And because they couldn't prove that, and this shows how important genealogies are, they were excluded from the priesthood until that claim could be tested by the Urim and the Thummim. And the Urim and the Thummim were two stones that were in the breastplate of the high priest, and they were a means by which God would sometimes divinely communicate with the people. And so until that could be consulted and their approval could be determined by God himself, they weren't allowed. They were treated as unclean, and they weren't allowed to participate. So let's look at the last...
Zach,
oh, yes. John?
Verse 60.
Mm-hmm.
That Tobiah, is that the same one that caused all the... or tried to cause all the problems when they were building the wall?
I'm going to wager probably not. That's a good catch, though, John. Tobiah is going to be a major character that comes into play later on. Reason why that resistance that they're facing later, and well, one, this is 60 years later, and we're told that these people that came back were the sons of Tobiah. So the sons of Tobiah, meaning would mean that Tobiah was even further back than the generation that did return, right? And so when Tobiah, the antagonist of Nehemiah, comes onto the scene later, that's going to be about 60 years. And so I'm going to imagine that that's probably a different Tobiah. But he does share the same name. Not only that, but remember, as we're going to see when we get into chapter 4, the resistance that's going to rise up against Ezra in rebuilding the temple, and the resistance that's going to rise up against Nehemiah, it's a specific group of people. Do you remember who it is? All right, we'll save that till we get there then. So we'll just hold on to that, and you can be thinking about that. But it was a specific group of people that were non-Israelites that are going to start causing problems for them. So, you know, as I think about that, I think it's pretty safe to say that's not the same Tobiah that's going to be plaguing Nehemiah and making his work harder. But that's a good catch on the name, John. All right, let's look at verses 64 through 66. So the whole assembly was 42,360. Beside their male and female servants, of whom there was 7,337, they had 200 male and female singers. Their horses were 736, their mules were 245, their camels were 435, and their donkeys were 6,720. So this is close to 50,000 people. Some have said, well, this is just the men, so there's probably more than that. Their wives and their children would have obviously come along. It's possible that numbered with the families were the wives and children, and it's possible that there's also that only the men were the ones who were numbered. So it's just really impossible for us to know. But it could have been anywhere from 50,000 to 150,000 people that come back in this first wave. Now, that may seem like a lot, but really it's just a fraction of the Jewish population. Why do you think it was that so few people returned? Because this is only a small portion of the people that were in captivity. Why do you think so many stayed behind?
I think a lot of them had gotten very prosperous in that country and didn't want to leave. They didn't want to go back.
Yeah.
They liked their new life.
Yeah, comfortable living where they were. Josephus wrote, "Many remained in Babylon, being unwilling to leave their possessions." That sounds like somebody else we read about way back in Genesis. Lot's wife. And those who returned, remember, this is their hearts were stirred up by God. So if things remained as they were, maybe they wouldn't have even went. But God stirred up a group of the people so that some of them went back. And God's doing this because of prophecies that he made, that he gave through the prophet Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 10, verse 22, and just you see the inspiration, the undeniable inspiration of God as you look at prophecy and then you look at these events being fulfilled. Isaiah would have been probably 250 plus years before the restoration, the return of the exiles. And so he's already speaking about things that are going to have to happen after the exile, which isn't going to happen for another 200 years. And he says there in Isaiah 10:22, "For though your people of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return." So he's speaking of an event that's 250 years in the future that's been revealed to him by God. Destruction is decreed, overflowing with righteousness. So God stirs up the heart of these people, and a small number, a small portion of the people go back. They're living in hope of God's promises. And so it's just something for us to think about. Are we like the ones who went back to Jerusalem, who are forward-looking to the promises that God has made? They're away from their ancestral home. They're away from the land of their fathers. They're away from the land where God had blessed them and that he promised he was going to make of them this great nation. Are we like them living in hope, or are we like the ones that stayed behind? You know, we're there in exile. We're living in the world. We need to have that sojourner-like spirit that the exiles who returned to Jerusalem possessed. We have to fight the urge and the temptation to become comfortable with what we have and to just keep our eyes and our goals and our lives earthbound. We need to be like the exiles who are living in hope of the promises of God rather than those who remain in the land of captivity. Tommy?
Yeah, I'm just curious. It seems like I have any idea how many Israelites was carried into captivity.
I don't. Mike could go back and read. At least three things happened whenever the Babylonians came and destroyed Jerusalem. They took some of the people back, a lot of the people back. They left some of them there, the very dregs and poorest of society, they left there. And then some of them just abandoned where they were at and moved to nearby territories like Egypt and other places. They resettled somewhere else. So some resettled, some stayed, and some were taken. So as to anybody know the answer to that? I don't off the top of my head know how many people were taken into captivity.
I think it's hard to calculate. I was reading about it. The only thing I remember, I read a couple of days ago, is that what was left, apparently, was about a third of the people that were there before.
Okay.
That doesn't mean they were all taken into captivity, though, because you just said some of them, probably quite a few left Jerusalem, you know, either to the mountains around it or whatever, or to Egypt, and quite a few were killed.
Yeah, well, that option too, I suppose. Many of them were destroyed in the destruction of Babylon. So, don't know how many there were, Tommy, that exactly went back. But we do know about how many returned. And we know from the prophecy Isaiah that only a remnant of them did actually return to Jerusalem. So, a small number. Now, whether that's a small number of those that were in exile or just a small number of those who had been scattered, can't be certain. But only a small number of the Jews seem to have returned.
Exactly. And also another group.
Yes, in fact, there are at least three waves of Jews that are going to return. We're reading about one In chapter 3, they're going to actually make the journey back and then begin rebuilding. Chapter 2 tells us who the ones are that came back in the first wave. So it's nearly 50,000 people that came back, or nearly 50,000 men, however you want to reckon that. There's going to be a second wave that comes that we'll read about in Ezra chapter 7 through 10. That's going to be a group that's led by Ezra, and he's going to bring a number of people with him as well. And then, as you pointed out, there's also going to be a third wave of Jews that will return some years later under Nehemiah's leadership. So there's at least three groups of Jews that return. So they come back in kind of three separate waves, at least three. There may be more, but I'm not calling to mind any more than that. And just as my study progresses, I'll be able to answer that more accurately. But there are at least three waves at the three different points in time in which the Jews return back home. So let's look at the last little bit of this, starting in verse 68. Some of the heads of the families, when they came to the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem, made freewill offerings for the house of God to erect it on its site. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury of the work 61,000 derricks of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, 100 priests' garments. Now the priests, the Levites, some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, and temple servants lived in the towns, and all the rest of Israel in their towns. So these freewill offerings are given. This is what's going to fund the rebuilding of the temple and the things that are there. So, interesting. This is not the tithe that the people were commanded to give. This is a freewill offering that was given by the people for the worship of God. In fact, it was something similar happening way back in the book of Exodus, whenever they're preparing to build the tabernacle. Essentially, God says, let anybody whose heart's moved and who wants to give to the building of the tabernacle, let them give a freewill offering. And so this is not part of the tithe that's taken. This is just people that want to give to this specific project. And who is it that draws a similar principle in the New Testament when it comes to giving? We spent about a year in that book, y'all. 2 Corinthians. It's Paul, 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Paul draws from this same principle, this free will offering, and some have thought, well, he had taken that from Moses and from the people here as the temple was being constructed, rather reconstructed, you might say. So it was a free will offering and not something that was demanded. So approximately 1,100 pounds of gold and approximately 6,000 pounds of silver. And as we're going to see in chapter 3, this is a minuscule amount in regard to how much Solomon's temple was. Well, we'll pick up in chapter 3 next week. Time just flew by there. So be looking at chapter 3. Make sure you're reading through 1 Peter chapter 1 in preparation for Johnny's class on Sunday morning. And be sure to grab some of the handouts. And if not this upcoming Wednesday night, next Wednesday night, then the week after I'll have some handouts for the next part of the book of Ezra. Guys, go sit down with Nana and Grumps, okay? I'll be right there.